Thank you, Damien, and welcome. Today we go straight to Amsterdam. Airports, many people say, are fascinating places. And correspondent Mary Guerin has spent hours at the airport from where Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 took off. As we now know, the flight was doomed, as its cargo of 298 passengers flew over Ukraine. They were blown apart by a surface-to-air missile. The world is still reeling from the news, as are the employees at Amsterdam's airport. Here's Mary Guerin.
24 hours ago, on a humid afternoon in London, two old conflicts were occupying my mind. I was preparing a trip to Fromelles to witness a dedication ceremony for Australian servicemen whose remains had been discovered in the French town that still graciously honours our diggers. And I was in the middle of scripting a story about a so-called dirty deal done between the British government and Irish Republicans after the Troubles, the shadows of bloody terrorism still haunting those two countries. Then came the newsflash about a plane crash. Surely not Malaysia Airlines. Surely not Ukraine, in the midst of its civil war and its dangerously escalating tensions with Russia. The story to combine some of the worst aspects of the worst news. Tragic, senseless loss. Widespread grief. The suggestion of terrorism and the threat of war. Within an hour, I was on my way to Amsterdam Airport. Schiphol Airport has become a strangely understated epicentre of grief. Intimately connected to the tragedy, this is where the plane took off, but with no emotional scenes of grieving families. Most journalists never caught a glimpse of the families as they were swiftly taken to an undisclosed location, but we knew they were nearby, maybe staying in the same airport hotels as us. As we saw the vision ourselves on the TV from that Ukrainian meadow of misery, as we read of body parts and glimpses of ordinary lives lying in that grass, we could only imagine what the families were going through here in Amsterdam, in this very pleasant airport. Airports are already the scenes of humanity's many high and many low marks, the comings and goings that mark our joining of company and our breaking away on what should be a mundane scale. I started to walk now through these corridors, wondering what the families now must make of departure signs. I started to concentrate on the children laughing with their families. Malaysia Airlines Regional Senior Vice President Huib Gorta had this to say about what he says is his airline's intention to offer a trip, if possible, to the next of kin who want to see the crash site.
The question here is that why are we offering the next of kin the opportunity, the possible opportunity in the future to go to Ukraine? History shows, when analysing these sort of events, that people need to go to the place where the accident occurred. There is a need, there is an emotional need to do so. That is a fact of life. Now, we are evaluating at this point of time whether that need is there and prevalent with the people who we're talking about, and we will make that decision looking at logistics and the people themselves, what they want.
For many families, Schiphol Airport can never be the final place of remembrance. The floral tributes are growing. An Indonesian man came with the first tribute of all to farewell his friend he dropped off the day before at the airport. Rudy Vol, an airport staff member, met him. He's also Indonesian, and he's lived in the Netherlands for 35 years. He told me what the tribute said.
It says, goodbye.
Selamat jalan, kawan.
Goodbye, my dear friend.
Yeah, yes. Farewell, my dear friends, and then I hope your God accept you in Dar Arses and bring you to a better life after this life. And then in the Dutch, niet te bevatten wat hier gebeurt. I cannot believe that this has happened. This is his friend brought him to the airport, yeah, to say goodbye.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, and now he's not anymore.
and you work here?
I work here. Yeah, but I'm feeling also very sad because I'm from Indonesia and there's so many people from Indonesia also aboard.
What do you think Dutch people think about who's to blame?
I don't know. Dutch people is they're always waiting for the fact and then they're making their conclusion. Yeah.
They're not jumping to conclusions?
No. That is Dutch people way to think. Don't make your opinion before you know all the facts.
Rudy Vol summed up what many believe of the Dutch: gracious, restrained, still wanting facts in this time of national grief. 24 hours after contemplating old conflicts, another has exploded. And I start to prepare to leave this airport that, for a moment, became a living, working shrine to 289 people who once passed through. This is Mary Geeran in Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam for Correspondence Report.
Our Africa correspondent Martin Cudahy has just returned from a trip to war-ravaged South Sudan. The conflict there has disrupted supply routes and forced farmers off their land, and as a result, people are starving to death. Not many Australians see starvation firsthand, but Martin did. Here are his thoughts.
We arrive in Akobo, the far east of South Sudan. It's right on the border with Ethiopia. The airstrip is a paddock. It's poorly fenced to keep out the wandering cattle. When I get out of the plane, I look around. It's hot and the glare is bright. Then I look down. I am immediately struck by the soil. It's a dark grey clay, cracked and dry. It's the same rich soil of my childhood. Immediately, I am transported back to the paddocks of the small farm where I grew up, outside Dalby, on the Darling Downs in southern Queensland. It's one of the richest cotton-growing areas in Australia, but it also grows wheat, barley, sorghum and oats, among others. We are here in Akobo to tell Australian audiences about a famine, and it doesn't add up. When I see the Akobo River, it's another contradiction. The waterway is full and flowing quickly. It's the perfect river for sustainable irrigation. These thoughts stay with me for the duration of our stay. It's a stay that's full of conflicting thoughts. When I see starving women and children, I want to help, but realise telling their story will do more help than anything I could do on the ground. Inside the local hospital, there are starving children. They lie on cheap beds with their mothers. These women are so patient. They sit there while their children slowly recover, passively staring, as if somehow accepting of the situation. I speak to some of the mothers inside, and two of them admit to eating grass and leaves and nothing else. Another woman is ashamed she can't produce enough breast milk for her baby. With a healthy 3-month-old daughter at home, the contrast is too obvious. The South Sudan government in Juba is not sending supplies to help with the malnutrition crisis. Akobo is a rebel-held area. The county commissioner explained that government salaries are not being paid and other services like the mobile phone network have been shut down. Almost everything in the marketplace comes from Ethiopia. The interview with the commissioner was in a paddock next to the river. While we were talking, cattle with long horns moved into the shot and started grazing. I asked him about them. Why couldn't starving people eat these cattle? He explains that last year a peace agreement had been negotiated with a neighbouring tribe. It's the first time in a generation that the two have not been fighting. The cattle belonged to the neighbours. If they were slaughtered, the fighting would start anew. It's yet another complication in an already complicated part of the world. The UN estimates that 50,000 children will starve to death by the end of the year if much-needed aid doesn't start flowing. But it's the soil I keep coming back to. They could grow their own crops. I think how easy it would be to set up a cropping operation here. Easy in the sense that the crops would grow well and it would be a simple solution for employment and much-needed economic activity in this desperately poor part of the world. But then I remember this is Africa. Governments change quickly and they reverse decisions meted out by their predecessors. In Kenya, 99-year leases have been granted that have been overturned. Economically, agriculture doesn't make sense. Then there is the fighting. Akobo is in Jonglei State, where some of the most intense battles have been. It's wishful thinking. No venture capitalist or intrepid farmer will set up here. Instead, people are relying on aid groups to bring in supplies and keep them alive. They do invaluable work, but it seems like such a wasted opportunity. As we leave, I take one last look at the soil and remind myself that I'm going home soon. Not home to Nairobi, but home, Australia, where there is no fighting and no famine. This is Martin Carahi for Correspondence Report.
Resurrecting an extinct prehistoric bird is an unusual issue to take to an election. And it's not often you hear the Leader of the Opposition apologise for being a man. Welcome to the New Zealand election campaign. Here's our correspondent, Dominique Schwartz.
Yes, the campaign has had its fair share of the usual and important policy issues dealing with health, education and economics. But it's the sideshow which has been upstaging the main act as New Zealand heads towards general elections on September the 20th. Prime Minister John Key and his National Party still look to be in the box seat for forming a ruling coalition. In fact, some commentators have dared muse that the ever-popular Teflon John might be able to form a government in his own right, something hitherto unthinkable under New Zealand's system of mixed member proportional representation. But it seems nothing is unthinkable or unmentionable in this campaign. Like bringing back the moa, New Zealand's flightless bird which died out 600 years ago. The largest of the species stood 3.5 metres tall and weighed 240 kilograms. Labor Shadow Minister Trevor Mallard suggested this month that New Zealand should resurrect the moa to boost tourism. It's not far-fetched, he told a business breakfast, given the advances that scientists are making in extracting DNA from extinct animals to reconstruct new life. And where better for the modern-day moa to roam, he says, than the forests northeast of Wellington, in his own electorate. To Jurassic Park? Not if you recreate the smaller of the species, according to Mr. Mallard, who wants one that he can pat on the head. It will capture people's imaginations, he enthuses. But plenty of people are wondering who or what captured his. Labor Party leader David Cunliffe, who had just promoted Mr. Mallard, was quick to point out that moa revival was not party policy. In his own words, the moa is not a goer. But not long afterwards, it was Mr. Cunliffe who had heads shaking when he apologised for being a man. Speaking at a conference on family violence where Labor pledged to spend $60 million combating the problem, he declared, "I'm sorry for being a man because family and sexual violence is overwhelmingly perpetrated by men." His comment was lauded by the head of the Women's Refuge, but caused an avalanche of criticism from, well, mainly men. Most political analysts say Mr. Cunliffe's apology was at best politically naive, at worst a disaster that's likely to alienate the male vote. But one pundit, Geoffrey Miller, reckons Labor has nothing to lose, and that both the moa and sorry comments were calculated risks aimed at keeping Labor in the news. And if there's one political player who knows how to hog the headlines, it's internet party founder and controversial internet businessman Kim.com. The naysayers who initially laughed off his political ambitions are now saying his party is likely to score a couple of seats in Parliament, enough to make waves. A German national, Mr.com, has alleged the New Zealand government granted him residency to pave the way for US authorities to extradite him for alleged copyright fraud. It's a conspiracy theory which was boosted this week by the release of documents which suggest political pressure was applied to immigration officials to allow Mr.com in. By the end of the week, voters were faced with the crazy situation of being told by Mr.com that they should vote for his internet party, even though he says the government should never have allowed him to be a resident. If you're confused, don't worry, so are most New Zealanders. But it's a spectacle nevertheless, and a circus which still has 2 months to run. In Auckland, this is Dominique Schwartz for Correspondence Report.
For many Australians pushing through the winter, summer can't come soon enough. In fact, right across the world, people dream about summer in songs, in poetry and in the movies. But in Beijing, it's a little different. Correspondent Stephen McDonnell.
How stuffy, how gluggy, how squelchy, how shrouded in smog before you're allowed to say that summer is crap. the smear of the last person's hand still fresh as you reach out to touch a rail, the body heat on a bus, the impact of temperature on non-refrigerated food left outdoors, the body parts exposed that are really best covered up. They're all there in Beijing. In Australia, summer is a religion, but Aussie summer is the summer of pools and prawns, beaches and barbecues. It's not the same season we have in the Chinese capital. If you were to squeeze the entire Australian population into one city locked down with traffic jams, where public transport is packed, and located in a barren, harsh landscape, then you'd have a similar starting point. Then you make these 20 million people live inland, in an area where the wind just disappears. In the freezing winter, there's virtually no precipitation, but the mid-year thunderstorms bring the rain. Sometimes it pours down, the wind comes along, and this place shines like you wouldn't believe. Other times it buckets down, there's no wind, and a thick soup hangs around for days, creating a mega sauna. What's more, summer is not a time for people here to go away. The big holiday period is during the Chinese New Year. So this metropolis just churns on throughout the summer months. Traffic, factories, businesses all keep going. Off the top of my head, I can only think of one or two outdoor pools in all of Beijing. You're not allowed to walk on the grass, because grass is for looking at. And if the thick smog covering the city does lift, it's only to allow a burning sun through, which fires up every concrete surface till the buildings and roads are throbbing with heat. If you look down into the street during the day, you'll see the white skin-loving Chinese girls hiding under parasols as they hurry to the next piece of shade. An Australian who, after living here, became convinced that the umbrella was a fine blocker of the sun's rays, thought she'd continue the practice when she returned home to Sydney. She was happily walking down King Street in Newtown with her Chinese parasol when a car drove past and someone called out, "Hey, it's not raining, love." You see, the experience is different. When I first came to Beijing, it was midwinter, and at minus 15 degrees, I asked my predecessor, John Taylor, what the summer would be like. Equally oppressive, he laughed. But you know, amidst the dull grey heat, there is joy. With no daylight savings, by 7 p.m, thankfully, the night comes upon us. Walking through the lovely tree-lined hutongs, the best side of Beijing is on display. Unpretentious funny blokes roll up their shirts and rub their round bellies as they drink down long necks of yanjing outside little family-run restaurants. Ordinary Chinese people, the Lao Bai Xing as they're called, let summer nights wash over them as if they don't have a care in the world. Spicy lamb kebabs or chuar are the food of choice to accompany the capital's draft beer. And under giant office towers or next to massive flyover car bridges, older people turn on their butterbox tape recorders and dance into the night. Fans, street pyjamas, dog walking and your mates are what Beijing's summer nights are all about. So you see, really you just have to get through the day and everything will be all right. This is Stephen McDonald, looking forward to a rejuvenating Beijing night for Correspondence Report.
Let's hope he gets it. The United States is renowned for its corporate culture of long working hours. For some high flyers, it all gets too much and they seek a quieter life outside of the city. Former sales rep Bill Mercier is one of those people, but his choice of work is not exactly relaxation-packed. He hosts weddings. Here's North America correspondent Michael Vincent.
Next to a lake amidst the forests of Vermont, with the Appalachian Trail running through the back of the property, Bill Mercier's place is idyllic. Let's just say it isn't your average wedding venue.
Well, I'm going to feed you. Just settle down.
Meet Alice, the pot-bellied pig.
Tiffany's going to bring you breakfast, honey. Tiffany's coming out with your breakfast.
She's a feature of this property and is beloved by its visitors.
Cranky perfect.
Alice isn't alone with a pony and six goats. Alice does not like the pony.
She doesn't?
No, because he gets in her food and she, she'll bark at him.
So that's
if
so
she
funny.
Hears clump, clump, clump in the barn, she starts to growl.
That's so funny.
And he's the sweetest boy in the world. He wouldn't bother anybody.
Bill Mercier has been running this wedding business with his family here 9 years.
You know, you hear about that thing called corporate burnout where, you know, and I really felt that. I was just kind of done. I was just cooked. I was finished with that life. Really tired of living in Northern Virginia where there's a lot of cars and a lot of lights and a lot of angry people. And I wanted a big change.
So you gave up the high-stress world of corporate life. You've got a big smile on your face right now. Yeah.
I think I know the question that's coming. Yeah.
To take on the very easygoing, no stress involved, you know, it's, you know, just a wedding.
Yeah, yeah.
And you do it every week. It's like a circus that bumps in and out every week.
Yeah.
Why?
You know, we have five children, and at the time, we only had one finished college, and that meant four more kids to put through college, and so we needed a business that was big enough to maintain a certain style of living, but also make enough money to, you know, feed and clothe five kids and hopefully get them through college. It's a lot of pressure, and I think one wedding a season, we get that bride or mother of the bride who really kind of goes, you know, above and beyond in her neediness, shall we say.
We call that feral in Australia. They go feral.
Yeah, they go feral. But otherwise, I think the folks who book us from Mountain Meadows kind of get that it isn't the most formal, the most exacting event.
Part of the wonderful experience up here, apart from the nature and the animals and the kind of very relaxed environment, was the live music, not just at the wedding, but actually in the tent. As someone who appreciates music, is that a dying art, the kind of the band, having the band at the wedding, and not just where can I plug my iPod in or the laptop in?
It is. We see it less and less. You know, I think since 2008, when people were really strapped for money, that's kind of when it started. How can we cut back? We still want to do the wedding, but especially in 2008, nobody can afford even their gas to come up here. How do we plan a menu that's less expensive? How do we cut corners and save money? And an easy thing to cut is a band. To me, there'll never be another, a lover
till the day I die. So you've been running the business 9 years. You've survived the recession. It's thriving. You've got another full summer of bookings ahead of you, I imagine. The goats want to be fed. What do you think you'll miss when you do give it up?
Mostly, it's hard to know. I love the look and feel of this place. I love the fact that it's surrounded by green hills and that there's a lake and that it's quiet and you hear birds all the time, and you might see a moose walk by. So if I don't find a place that has those components, certainly I would miss all of them.
That was Michael Vincent in Vermont. That's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Elizabeth Jackson. Thanks for your company. Back now to Damien Carrick and Sunday Extra.